Welcome to Emotional Sobriety, the next step in recovery with Dr. Alan Berger and Tom Rutledge.
We have Samantha Duggan, who was just with us at the Recovery Reimagined 2025 conference. And I'm going to let Alan give a more expansive introduction to our guest today before she can introduce herself.
I had a great, you know, an incredible opportunity to do the last workshop with you. It is Dr. Samantha Duggan. And we also want to hear about your new book, because I thought it's really, you captured some very important, you know, dimensions of recovery. But I just wanted to share with you on a personal note how I found that experience that we did really great in so many ways. And I'll try to articulate what those were. First of all, I thought that we had a wonderful rapport in terms of our ability to kind of move in between each other's comments and ideas. And I really appreciated that, because I feel this with a few people. I feel this with Tom 99% of the time. There was only 1% of the time we had a little bit of a cross.
We had a keynote argument. Yeah.
About 100 people. It was, we've cleaned that up. So we've done
it. Yeah, we've done well. It was a good building in our relationship. It really helped for me.
Yeah, me too. It was. We stayed connected through trouble. I mean, we didn't
I was so surprised. It never occurred to me one time that you were going to be upset with me afterwards. It's like, I mean, it's like, and that's a new thing for me in period. That just tells that therapy may pay off.
It does. Right on. But, you know, and that's what I found when we were doing our workshop, is that you would always come in and sweeten the pot. Which I appreciated so much, is that it was this idea of synergy, right? 1 + 1 = 5 that day. It didn't just, I just wanted to say from you know, my heart to your heart, is that it really was a very special experience. And I'm very much looking forward to the video that Patrick's editing right now and once it comes out, because there was such richness. And that's the other thing I was going to say. The richness we brought to the discussion of recovery capital. And I think I even mentioned to you, maybe even in the talk, is that this other Patrick, who was at the conference, Patrick Little, went to the other discussion that more academics had about recovery capital. And he turned to them at one point and says, you know, what's missing from this whole thing is any discussion of spirituality. And that's where you started. I mean, that's what I know. It was so cool.
I can't help myself.
No, it's good. I'm glad for that, you know, but I just wanted to say those before we get going. So please let us know let them know. I have a real sense of who you are from our time together, but tell everybody about yourself and what you're doing, and especially about your book that's out.
Okay. Well, I suppose I was a psychologist before I was a person in recovery, and I know that that's not always the pattern. So I was always interested in the intersection between our physical health and mental health that I was particularly interested in. So I ended up doing a PhD in clinical neuropsychology, bit of a deep dive into PTSD following physical illness. So I was there reading all of that information at the start. When I looked back through the lens of my family history, I think it was inevitable that I was going to be drawn towards a helping role, you know, when you consider who I am and then what I'd been through. So a real classic, like, I want to understand other people, but I was really trying to understand me. And then there was what I suppose I would look back now and go a geographical. So my husband followed me to Scotland, and then I left academia when he wanted to move to Spain for his work. And so I moved to Spain quite a while ago, and then here. I moved here when I was 1 year sober. Uh-huh. And I had young children, and I took a sideways detour. And that's when I trained to run parenting groups, because what I discovered was that a head full of theory and early recovery and young children And I knew I didn't want to be in the ivory tower of academia anymore. I had figured out early on that I didn't want to work in the NHS. I discovered during my clinical training that the smell of hospitals was off-putting to me. So I knew I couldn't work for the NHS as a clin psych in a team. So I moved in this direction of being super interested in and making my work all about family. And I started to think of it as, right, there is the ambulance at the bottom of the cliff, and we need that for sure. I ended up needing the ambulance at the bottom of the cliff big time. but I want my work to be about the fence at the top, you know. So I do ambulance at the bottom of the cliff work as well, you know. So I still practice step 12, giving it away like it was given to me for free. So I love my work, unprofessional work, my non-professional work, I should say. My non-professional work in the 12 rooms of 12-step fellowship is still really important to me. But my professional work, I decided I wanted to be the fence at the top of the cliff, which I understood to be about helping parents to be more confident, and also to be more aware of the ways in which they inflict the unintended wounds on their children, and to help them, you know, maybe not do that as badly as they otherwise would. So that's been my work for 15 years now, thereabouts. And that's, I suppose, why I wrote my book in 2019. So I just kind of bashed it out. And I had an idea, I would say, an inspired idea. Yeah. So I would say my higher power put this idea for a book on my heart, and that it would follow the step 11 prayer, the prayer of St. Francis of Assisi, and that it would be stories based. I think I'm definitely a little bit of a storyteller. And I sat down and I wrote stories about raising children and being a psychologist and being a woman in recovery. And yeah, I wrote down, I guess, looking back, I didn't know what was going to come out, but you know, stuff came out, and that's the book now. So it's part memoir, part parenting advice, I suppose, or parenting suggestions, parenting principles, maybe actually I might call it. Memoir crossed with self-help parenting suggestions. So that's what it is. And when my daughter went off to university last October, I pulled it out of the drawer and decided it was time to edit it. So that's it. There it is there. Channels of Peace.
Nice.
So, yeah, that's me. That's my work. I do other bits and bobs as well. So I met Patrick actually because a friend of mine who's in recovery and in the House of Lords summoned me one day, and I jest, but only slightly. He's very good at directing people to go off and do things in the recovery world. And he called me into the House of Lords one day for the inaugural meeting of the all party parliamentary group for 12-step recovery. And he asked me if I would be secretary of that. And that was how come I met the Berlin Circle. So I was doing that work, working with politicians, working with people from the House of Lords, House of Parliament, going around the country, trying to raise awareness about 12-step recovery. And here in the UK, I don't think you have it so much in the US, but here in the UK, I think somewhere along the line between when AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, first arrived, we got muddled about anonymity, and we started to understand anonymity as secrecy. And you know, and that's not what it's about, you know. So there's nothing stopping anybody speaking about their recovery in their world, in their family, in, you know. And so, yeah, it was really on my heart to share that. And that was how come I met Patrick. So, yeah, I've done that kind of work too. And I work with serious sexual abuse and physical abuse survivors as well through another charity that I work with. But yeah, mostly my big thing is the parents' stuff.
Yes.
So not much. Yeah. You just pretty much just don't have a whole lot to do. Yeah.
One of these fine days, I must get a job and figure out what it is
I'm a little tired from just listening. It's like I'm going. Wow. I think the privacy versus secrecy, the anonymity and secrecy was the principle of my addiction. It's like
right.
I always tell people that the addictive voice in your head always begins with this. Shh. Nobody needs to know this.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, and you know, I was really happy because I came up with this, I suppose it was a catchphrase. It wasn't rocket science, but I just thought, you know, anonymous, not invisible. And that caught on.
Right.
And mm-hmm. I was really happy about that. So, you know, after COVID happened and after everything opened up again, we had a celebration service in Westminster in a beautiful, beautiful church there, the small one next to Westminster Abbey that everybody knows. So it's a beautiful church. And just to try and encourage people in recovery to be visible, and we had this, like, you know, we had multiple fellowships represented. It was really beautiful because I think recovery is not something to be hidden away. It's something to be celebrated and definitely to be visible with it. You can't do step 12 if you're not visible.
Well, there's that movement has taken place in the United States too, with especially the one group that's really advocating people talking and sharing about their long-term recovery. And like you said, the difference between secrecy and anonymity, and it's got, I mean, early on, it was relevant here in the States because in the 30s, there was so much stigma associated and attached to alcoholism. And as we're seeing with other issues, I mean, that's the case. But, you know, the one thing that's happened, at least, you know, that I see in the States, we've matured a bit in that direction. And now people are being able to talk about issues and not being shamed for it and not being looked at as less than as by being considered as human. We still got a long way to go. But Mrs. Ford, I was thinking of her as you were talking, because she was so courageous when she came out and she made a declaration, because she opened a door for so many women to face their alcoholism, and her impact on reducing some of that stigma was huge in the United States.
Mm, yeah, good for her. Yeah.
Well, it's like you say, Samantha, that, I mean, without people being brave enough to come out and share openly, it's like so many other people don't have an opportunity. I grew up professionally in AA, and like you, I was treating alcoholics and addicts by day and drinking by night. So it's like I thought I was the only one who did that, but I found that a lot of people got in the back door, and I've always just figured that in past lives I must have just been so screwed up that they said, well, let's just make him a therapist, and maybe if he just has to sit in therapy all the time, something will get through, you know. And it's like, you know, it's taking. But I was going to say, but I remember here in Nashville, decades ago, Larry Gatlin, you know who he is, probably Alan or Patrick, he was a big star back in those days, and I mean, very, very big on in the music business. And he just came out as a cocaine addict and just started talking about the nitty gritty of it. And I mean, nobody was doing it then either. I mean, he was just a brave man. It's like he was talking about being in a hotel room on his hands and knees trying to get the cocaine out of the shag rug. You know, it's like, I mean, I remember him doing it. And it's just like he just did it. And then that's just exponentially grown as people have done this. So there is a long way to go. But man, we've done a lot with that.
Yeah, yeah. And I think we're experimenting as well. I mean, it's not like I don't get the fear of stigma and people's judgment. I get that. So, you know, as a result of that APPG work, for example, I got approached and asked if I would speak at the conference, the annual conference for the Royal College of GPs here in the UK? I said, yeah, sure, of course I will. And it was, you know, things hadn't still fully come back post the COVID era. So it was online. There were conversations recorded, videos recorded, that kind of thing, Q&A. And after we recorded it and I hung up, you know, like this, and I came off the calls and I went, what have you done? You've just outed yourself to the Royal College of GPs as having been in Edinburgh's Royal Infirmary, hung over taking patient histories. It's like, are you insane? You know, it's professional suicide, surely, to have done that. But you know, it wasn't. It wasn't. But it was a fear. It's really scary. To do it. But the way to break down stigma is to not try and find stigma in the other people's brains.
Yeah.
And zap it. It's to bring what's not spoken about out into the open and speak about it. You know, if I wait till you've no prejudice, I'll never speak.
Yes.
Well the powerful part is it's going to start with you anyways. Like if I'm afraid of your judgment, you know, codependently, it's like, I, you know, whatever you think of me determines how I feel about myself. But it's not that. It's whatever I think you think of me, because I don't need you for this relationship. I'll just make up stories about that. I can tell by looking at you, you hate me, and I don't need any more information. And so that's what you did, is you get back and you go like, no, okay, well, it's my own stigma on myself. It's like, I need to face that judgment. And once you can do that, you can face all of it.
That's it. That's it. The really important thing isn't what the other person thinks of me. It's what I think of me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, and that's at the heart of emotional sobriety. You know, now if we connected to this podcast, that's what one of the very central principles is, how to keep our emotional center of gravity over our 2 feet and not give it to others, you know. And when we give it to others, it creates this other validation of our self-esteem, right? Other-based self-esteem. I'm okay if you think I am, instead of I'm okay. And see, I always have to warn people, when we say that we keep our self-esteem over our 2 feet, doesn't mean we're not open to feedback, because we always are. You know, if we're working a program, a cornerstone of emotional sobriety is humility. It means I don't always have it together. I can be wrong. I can make mistakes. There can be gaps in my knowledge. I'm open to that feedback and to learning. Yeah. And I'm not going to reflexively, automatically take on what you're saying as though that's my truth.
Right. It's a process, isn't it? I can remember getting there. I mean, one of the earliest discoveries of my journey in recovery was how devastating mistakes were to me. I mean, it felt so devastating when I thought I'd done anything wrong, or if anybody pointed anything out to me. It was like all my insides just fell out through the bottom. And it was sitting in recovery rooms that I started to understand that. So we were talking before the cameras started to roll about the, you know, using triggers to help you learn what it is that you actually feel and think about yourself, and then to examine all of that. But so piece by piece, mistakes and feedback started to be less devastating. And I can still remember the moment where I dropped something in my kitchen, some plate of food that I was about to feed my children. And my head automatically went, oh, you dropped food. Need a cloth. And my brain zooted back in time about, I don't know, some years earlier, when my husband and I were engaged but not married. So it was a while previously. And I dropped a plate of food in his house. And my God, I cussed myself to high heaven. Oh, you're so stupid. What do you think? Look at the mess you know, classic codependent self-hatred, horrendous self-talk. And I did it out loud. And in that moment, I remember going to my next meeting and sharing this extraordinary progress that I'd made. It's like, I did it. I dropped the exact same problem. I dropped a plate of food and I just went, oh, look, you dropped food. You better get a cloth. And that's
That's
I think that's the goal, right? That's emotional sobriety in the face of mistakes.
Yeah.
Yes, yeah, right.
Dude, does everybody have a spilled milk anecdote? I mean, even before I got to recovery, I used to tell people who'd listen, because I used to love and to drink and tell stories. There would actually be tears in my house. You'd get into trouble for literally spilling milk. I have a flashbulb memory from before I'm about 6 years of age. Maybe I'm about 6 years of age, and I knocked over the milk jug at the kitchen table, and there was literally hell to be paid, because of course my poor mother was triggered by that. You know, milk was precious when she was a girl, you know, and that they couldn't afford to spill milk, you know. So my mom had this reaction. She yelled at me, and then I, you know, 20 years later, I yelled at myself when I dropped anything. But through recovery.
Yeah, it's a great example of the fact that we're always teaching clients that, you know, whatever it is. Alan and I have talked about this before, that we don't people think we're therapists, so we must treat crazy people. And what we've come to is the idea that we spend our day showing people how they're not crazy. You know, and that's a great example that story. It's like, you come by it honestly. Why are you yelling at yourself for that? Well, that's what you learned. It's like, until you unlearned it and learned something different. And it's like, yeah. I don't have a spilt milk story, but I always tell people, you know, you can learn things by doing things right, but you really can learn a lot of stuff by screwing things up. And man, I got a lot to work with, you know. It's like, and most of us do. I mean, it's just like, I always want, that's a reframe. Just go like, look how much material you have to go with in all the stuff that you have to learn. It's like, and anyways, I say it with humor, but it's the truth. It's like, if you're willing to look at that stuff, it's like, there's no end to learning.
Absolutely. And, you know, my sponsor drummed step two into me in that situation. You know, I'd ring her, because before I didn't panic when I dropped a plate of food, I'd have probably had to ring her, you know, before I could get on with the rest of my evening, you know. I learned to emotionally balance through talking through the others in recovery who could help me get onto an even keel. And, you know, but peace, she always loved to remind me of step two. So that was the first thing she used to say to me: your higher power has not abandoned you. Step two still applies. So this situation, she learned me to reframe everything. Every trigger was the opportunity for looking at this through a step two, three situation. It's like, okay, so this has happened, but do you believe that you're going to be restored to sanity? Yes, I do. Right. Mm-hmm. So let's practice turning it over and trusting that God can bring good stuff out of this if we let him.
Yeah. Beautiful.
That is one of our nutshells that we talk about as mm-hmm. nutshell emotional sobriety, is that trouble doesn't mean something's wrong.
Right.
Trouble, just a signal. It's just a signal that something needs to be learned.
Well, the key is what Samantha said, is the word we use all the time, opportunity. It's like, that's the big reframe that's in all of this with all of us. It's like, rather than, you know, rather than that should monster beating the crap out of ourselves, it's like no, we have something to learn. And, and part of what we have to learn is to stop listening to that asshole.
Yeah.
Well, that old idea that, you know, where we focus our energy, you know.
That's where it goes.
That's where it goes, man. Mm-hmm. I mean, where you focus is where your energy goes. And so if I'm beating myself up, the lesson gets lost completely.
Right.
But if I focus like you did, and what was wonderful about it, how automatic that was for you. It just showed your progress and how all of a sudden we start to integrate these things and we have a very different response to the situation. You know, this guy Murray Bowen described the difference between a reactive response versus an active response. Reactive is that automatic, I'm going to beat myself up, I'm a loser, nobody's going to love me, you know, look at what I just did, right? It's an unforgivable mistake kind of a thing, right? I shouldn't
right.
be,
yeah.
You know, God, lock me up. And versus the active response you had was, wow, okay, I dropped it, let me get it cleaned up. It's a plate. Nobody died. There's no big deal. No. You know, you had, see, the other thing we talk about in emotional sobriety is having the in alignment with reality, meaning having an appropriate and honest relationship with reality. And you were able to do that. It was such a good story about you dealt with the situation as the situation was. You didn't make it into something more than it was, which was great.
Well, let me just throw this in, because for people listening, because I'm always aware that I just remember how easily, how judgmental I could be and still can be of myself, especially when I'm listening to other people talk about doing well. It's like, you correct me if I'm wrong, Samantha, but the way she got to that place, which was what I would call unconscious competence, where she didn't have to think about it. It's like driving a car now. You don't have to think about it. It's like she got there because she because of her work, repetition. She beat herself up for dumb things over and over and over again, caught that or had people, therapists, friends, sponsor, catcher, over and over and over again. And that's how, that by doing it that way, you get to the place of unconscious competence. But it doesn't just happen because we decide it.
Well, right. I was going to ask Samantha, what do you attribute that progress to?
Oh, well, what Tom just said, I practiced, you know, and I took the suggestions very seriously when I got to recovery, you know. So they told me that when I had a problem, any resentment, and I didn't really understand the words, they're just like, just look, when you're mad at anybody, ring me. And I did that. So, you know, I really did steep myself in those, in all of those suggestions. I did a lot of written step 10s. I got outside help as well, you know, and I'm blessed with my sponsor. You know, she introduced me to all the work that she had done. And I tested some of it. So I really took to inner child work and parts work. My imagination probably stood me in good stead. I'm a curious person, and I had such a big resentment about my family of origin as well. So I was very happy to look at the roots of it in my family of origin, you know, that tendency to blame as well. You know, I uncovered, I remembered that spilt milk story, for example. And through examining that, I uncovered all of the faulty beliefs. I think playing the tape forward, so I would play the tape forward on the belief I discovered was underplaying it. So I had this idea, you shouldn't ever make mistakes. Clearly, that's ridiculous. My parents never made mistakes. I don't think that's true, you know, and then you can add, as an adult, you can examine, well, do I think it's okay to make mistakes? And I discover, well, actually, it's inevitable that you make mistakes. But I think as well, fluke situations, my very first ever AA meeting, before the meeting got started, have I told this story before? We used to share, a part of the process of the meeting was, has anybody got a joy or a sorrow that they'd like to share? And so somebody would always offer one of those two things. So I was introduced to the idea of celebrating your progress very early on, from my very earliest meetings. And so, you know, you said, Tom, sometimes it can be triggering hearing people share the positive. And it was triggering for me hearing people share the positive. But going back to that meeting week after week and going, oh, my God, I don't like hearing when people share the positive. I'm like, ah, but bit by bit by being exposed to that. So recovery.
It was opportunity. It was your opportunity. And you took it. Yeah,
I took them. It's part exposure therapy, isn't it? You know, and then the Holy Grail. I remember in my training, remember generalization? What are the conditions that we need to create? How do we generalize from the lab to life? How do we generalize from the treatment center to out there in the real world? This, you know, I think, but there was also obviously tons of grace and mystery. At some point, all of the elements practicing, playing the tape forward, trying on other ways of thinking. I had my expression was generating alternative hypotheses. I do speak a little bit still like a scientist, you know, So, yeah, could I generate an alternative hypothesis here? And then one day, magically, it all just came together that day when I dropped the plate.
Very cool.
That's very beautiful. Cool. So can you guys tell us what recovery capital is?
You know, in just a quick synopsis of it, it's just the amount of resources, both internal and external, that we can mobilize and stay connected to help us initiate and sustain our recovery. I mean, I think the best way to think about it, and both are important. I mean, you know, later on in recovery, and Samantha is really describing it well, is recovery gets internalized, right? And it becomes from the inside out, but in the beginning, it's outside in. I mean, we got to get a lot of, new information. You know, I remember the experience I had with my sponsor, Tom. He was the first person to see me, not to see me as my problems and as who I wasn't, but to see me as a person and what my potential was. And that was unbelievably valuable. Later on, I heard people say, we're going to love you until you love yourself. That was a version of it. But this was even more specific than that. I mean, I felt his love for me and his concern for me. I still do, even after all this time. But it was more specific about being seen.
He saw you. I've heard you talk about that before. It's like that was, I mean, for you in particular, that was so healing.
It was so healing. And that happened several other times in recovery. You know, when I started to go to therapy, I felt seen. You know, when I went to my first weekend marathon encounter group, that was an unbelievable experience of having space for me in the world, and started to see that, you know what, maybe I can fit into this world in some way, and that there's something possible that's outside of having to drink and use to be a part of.
Well, when I think about the capital that you guys are talking about, because I never thought of that term, and I've followed what Alan's been saying, and what I understand from your work, Samantha, is one of the things I take from it is it's you start from the ground up. And you do everything, willingness to do what it takes. And I was telling a story to a client who's relapsing quite a bit and has been recently. He said, what do I do? And I said, well, one of the things you do is, I said, when I was first sober, what I did every day was not drink. And I said, I mean that actively. I mean, every day I could have told you how many drinks I did not have, because I was not having drinks. That's what I was doing. You know, now you talk about going forward, because you build that capital up. It's like, if you ask me, why don't you drink? I go like, well, I don't drink. It's like, it's been 39 years. I mean, can I drink? Boy, I've proven I can. So I'm sure that stability is still there. But it's like, no, I don't do that. But at first, I want people to know that's a huge accomplishment. Whatever that is for somebody, it may be something other than not drinking, but it's like just doing that thing over and over and over again. It may be boring, but it's like essential in establishing the foundation.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, when I've just had a conversation with somebody today who is in recovery and whose daughter is now in early months recovery. And she's, she was speaking about the different expectations that she has versus her, the girl's father, who is not in recovery, doesn't understand it. And he's talking about getting jobs and all of this kind of thing. And it's too much. Yeah. And we were just talking about how, when you're counting months, it's like, did you have a drink today? No. Great day. That's a great day. And I remember them saying that to me, and part of me didn't believe it, but part of me did, because I trusted these people, and learning, getting more trust in myself and believing their way of thinking. And it rolls from there. But this, so the internal resources. So I learned to consider the alternative hypothesis that maybe it was a good day because I hadn't had a drink, you know? And then 1 year, many years later, my sponsor, I rang her and I was like, well, I haven't done enough. I suffered from, I'm lazy, I don't do enough, I'm wasting my life for a long time in recovery, very long time, maybe the first 10 years. And she said, okay, when we get off this phone call, I want you to sit down and I want you to write me a list of everything you've done today. And I want everything on it. I want shower, brushed teeth, because you did not do those things as a regular thing when you were, when you were drinking. Yeah. So yesterday I got 5 call outs, right, from ladies in recovery. And I took them and they interrupted my day, of course. And that meant I worked till 8 p.m. last night. And when I finished my work, because I'd had so many interruptions, I could feel the, I didn't do enough today because the illness can't tempt me with, how about a drink? Wouldn't a glass of wine be nice? Like we're way past that. That doesn't tempt me at all. Yeah. So the illness has morphed into, you didn't do enough today. So I did that.
That's your list.
That's my list. And that's recovery capital. You know, that's an internal resource. I don't know when I last wrote what I did today list. It was years ago. But yesterday I could, and it wasn't rational. It was just the illness going, you didn't do enough, because I'd had 5 interruptions. But you know, every one of those step 10 calls is on that list as something valuable I did today.
That's beautiful. I have to own up. That's my list.
Wake up.
That's for the week, by the way. It's like, that's for the whole week. It's like,
yeah,
I am a proud lazy man. It's like,
yeah, I have a friend in recovery and she's we did a lot of our emotional sobriety work together. We're different primary fellowships, but we were in the same sort of fellowship for a bit. And she's from she was the head girl in her all girls British fancy school, you know, and she talks about in her family of origin, she's like, circling the moon backwards in piloting the spaceship and in high heels whilst on your way to collect your Nobel Prize. That's the standard from her family of origin.
Oh my God. That's a great image, isn't it?
Wow.
Great image. Well, it's been having you on the show, Samantha. It really is.
Yeah.
Good enough to have, if you're open to it and willing, we have you back again, because it's been a great, great dialogue and discussion. And Tom, your sense of humor has really come back, man. I'll tell you.
Thank you. It's like it has. It's like it survived, didn't it? Are you noticing now it's getting in the way?
No, not at all. It away for a while, man. It was
when I was going through treatment, I didn't think I was going to be, it was hard. So, but I'm glad to hear that. Yeah. Thank you.
There wasn't a lot of things you were finding funny, but man, it's really been wonderful to watch your recovery, because not only are you cancer free, but you've recaptured, reintegrate.
Well, to what you just said, I'm back to where I find everything funny. It's like, I think I've told you guys, I have this disclaimer on my wall in my therapy room that a friend of mine did for me. And he said, you need your clients to read this. And it just says, just because I think everything is hilarious doesn't mean I'm not taking you seriously. And when he first showed it to me, I said, no, I don't think people need that. And he goes, Tom, you laugh at everybody. And one of the things I've always told, I told somebody yesterday when they're a new client, I say, and this is one of those things I can actually own, is absolutely true about me. You'll never get shame from me. You're not going to, you can't find it. It's like, you're not going to get shame from me, but I will always make fun of you. It's like, and that's because I can't help it. But it's like, yeah, And God, well, all of us, what would we do without our sense of humor?
Well, I can remember, and I looked into this more, but one of the things we studied was the, in, I think it was undergraduate level, was the psychology of, you know, Maslow's self-actualized people. Mm-hmm. That was the language that was in vogue in those days. And they had the qualities of people who were self-actualized, and sense of humor is part of it. You know, psychopaths don't have a sense of humor. The enlightened do. Yeah, I always remember that.
Well, good. I have a takeaway. At least I'm not a psychopath.